Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. Yaakov Katz here, together with Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, we're talking this week, a few days before you're actually heading off to Glasgow, Scotland, to attend this international summit about climate change. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett will be there alongside two of his other ministers. So we'll talk about that in a bit and how climate change has really become a very important topic.
You know, I have to interject that Queen Elizabeth is going to be in Glasgow, and we started this podcast with me talking about meeting Prince Charles, so maybe it'll bring me good luck. I'll meet the Queen too.
You never know. I mean, listen, although recent reports have said that maybe she's not doing so well. I'm not a close royal watcher, but I did read something about that.
Well, the whole Church of England is praying for her.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll pray for her and that you should get that meeting. But before we talk about Glasgow, there's been a lot going on in the diplomatic front. And I got to tell you, you know, I was thinking about this morning. A long time ago, when I was in high school, I was really bad at basketball. And one summer, I went to like this basketball camp. Okay, and I'm pretty tall, and I'm not a necessarily a very big guy, but I guess I have presence and I'm tall and I take up space. So they basically said to me, listen, I can't dribble. I have no long shot, but just stand under the basket. You're going to get the ball. And all you got to do is do a layup. So you like dribble once, turn around and shoot in the basketball into the basket by hitting the backboard. Right. Like really simple. And they're like, Yaakov, just stick there and keep on practicing this like 100 times until I got it right. And that's what I would do in all the games. I would stay in that corner. If I got the ball, I got the ball, did the quick dribble, turned around and did the layup. And it was easy. That's what should have happened with the NGOs and Benny Gantz's designation of them as terrorist organizations on Friday. It should have been an easy layup. It should have been simple, right? You update the Americans, you update the Europeans, you update your fellow ministers in the cabinet, you release briefing materials to the press, to ambassadors, you get it out, nothing too complicated. But instead, this is insane what's been happening, right? He announces it, ministers say they didn't know about it.
He didn't really announce it. That's also what's like sort of ridiculous about this whole thing, is that it like went up on the like chat, like on the website or whatever, and then people just slowly discovered it. Some related like think tanks and whatever noticed it and sent it out to media, and that's when it started going public. And like, are you stupid? Like, don't make it public in any form if you don't have a media strategy for something that it should be completely obvious that it's going to be controversial.
Yeah, no, and not only was there no media strategy, so no briefing material, no press conference, no video explaining. We're now in this tit for tat with the Americans, where this Ned Price, the spokesperson for the State Department, said we're going to ask for clarifications. Israel then claimed officials in the Defense Ministry, assumingly from Benny Gantz's office, claimed no, we actually updated the Americans. Now Israel sending Shin Bet officials and foreign ministry officials there, but they're saying that the foreign ministry officials, Josh Zarka, I think is his name, already updated some Americans, and the Americans are saying, well, we still don't know about it. I mean, again, this should have been simple and easy, right? And how Lahav, please explain to me, how did we seem to mess this up?
Right, like not only do we know exactly which Israeli updated the State Department, it's Yoshua Zarka, I have a pretty good guess of who he updated, which I think is State Department Acting Coordinator for Counterterrorism, John T. Godfrey. The Foreign Ministry refuses to name names, and so they won't confirm that for me, but they did say it was the Counterterrorism Department, and that's the top guy. Now, so my only guess, and I was sort of speculating together with someone from the Foreign Ministry who really didn't know what went wrong. He was, you know, they're also kind of baffled, is that whoever Zarka talked to in the counterterrorism department didn't take it seriously or didn't think there was going to be any kind of problem with it and just went on with his day. And possibly in order to sort of cover for his own mistake, then could have even said to whoever, his higher ups in the State Department, oh, no, I didn't know. But either way,
that only explains Lahav, the U.S.
The internal. Right.
Yeah. The public doesn't explain the public diplomacy mishap
here. Right. I don't have a good explanation. I will tell you that, you know, I've been reporting on this story for a few days, and everyone I talked to, I asked them, why did it take 24 hours for any information other than the official technical legal document to be released to the public? And, like, the answers that I get are, let's say, not satisfactory. Things like, 24 hours isn't such a long time. It's not even, it's actually more like 36 hours. It was Friday morning until right after Shabbat ended. So, like, you know, 7-ish on Saturday night.
You know, without maybe sounding too harsh, but whoever said to you that 24 hours is not a long time, that person probably shouldn't be in his or her job anymore. Because if they fail to understand that if you leave a vacuum for 24 hours in today's media environment and you don't fill it with something, that it's going to be filled with another narrative, which is exactly what happened, and not realize that 24 hours is insanely long, then there's a problem. And you know what this connects to, in my view, is go back to May when Israel bombs a building in Gaza, which housed the 12-story building, housed the AP, the Associated Press Bureau, the Al Jazeera Bureau. No one was killed because Israel warned everyone to leave the building. They all left the building. But and you were writing about this at the same time. Also, it was another of these rounds of where Israel did not update the Americans before, AP being one of the biggest news agencies in America. We got condemnations from Blinken, from the White House. And then Israel said, yeah, we wrote the story. Remember, you wrote it. It was on the Sunday. Yes. I think it was the eve of Shavuot. And it was that, from your sources, Israel has supplied the Americans with a smoking gun. Netanyahu, who was then prime minister, goes on Face the Nation, I think it was, and says he was asked about the Jerusalem Post article, confirmed that we were speaking with the Americans through our defense channels. And then Blinken the next day says, hey, I haven't seen anything. Right? I mean, why can't we get this right? It should be easy. Think before you do. Get your papers ready. Create a briefing material. And you're the one, Lahav, who told me that this was based on a report largely that was put up by the Strategic Affairs Ministry a few years ago called Terrorists in Suits or something. And all this material was available.
Right. And then, you know, Gilad Erdan, who's the ambassador to the UN, he wants, like, credit, right? So he put out his own press release of, like, when I was strategic affairs minister, we said this and this. But I mean, they deserve somewhat credit. That was the first time that really the government, the first time that I know of, that the government picked up this information that was readily available, that think tanks like NGO Monitor, whose president Gerald Steinberg we will talk to later on this episode, you know, had been talking about this for more than 10 years. So it should not have been hard for them to have this information available. It shouldn't have been hard because they needed it in order to make their own determinations, but also, like, it's there, you know, like, for me as a reporter writing about it, I knew immediately what they were talking about. So how could the Americans, like, how could they have not explained it immediately? It is really strange. And I also just think, like, there's no difference between the last government and this one on it, which is amazing. I mean, Yair Lapid is a media maven, you know, like, he was writing columns for 20, 30 years and was on TV, and he's supposed to understand these things.
What I think this comes down to is maybe an anachronistic view of the media of Israel, of these Israeli officials, of thinking it's not worth it, we don't care, just ignoring it. That's what happened with the AP, that's what happened now, and they're still stuck in this mindset and they just don't get it. And for some reason, that's just going to keep on happening.
I think Bennett has that mindset. I'm not sure about Gantz, but I don't think Lapid has that mindset, which is why when there started being reports that, like, Bennett and Lapid didn't know and Gantz just, like, pushed it through, I found them to be credible, although, you know, their offices really deny it. And to me, the fact that it wasn't announced, it was just, like, quietly put on some website and then people found out about it, shows that there was some sort of screw up, like, in that sense. That it wasn't so much that Bennett and Lapid didn't know about it, it was just the way the defense ministry and the justice ministry rolled it out. And the justice ministry, by the way. Nobody's blaming Gideon Saar for this, but it is the justice ministry, too.
Right, that's one of the things that Gerald Steinberg tells us later in the interview on this episode, is that, according to the information that he had, it was going to be coming out the following week. And he was actually surprised when it came out earlier than it was supposed to. Lahav, this kind of ties in to an extent, in my view, to what happened over the weekend when Naftali Bennett flew on Friday to Sochi, Russia, for a meeting with Vladimir Putin, their first face-to-face. He was supposed to be on the ground just for a few hours, make it back for Shabbat. But he got stuck there for Shabbat. I'm beginning to get a little suspicious. You and I tweeted about this together or at each other that he enjoys being away Shabbat and outside of Israel. Maybe he gets a little more quiet than being home with the four kids and having to wash the dishes at the Shabbat meals. But this is already the third trip that he's been stuck for Shabbat or for a Chag. So, you know, I'll leave it to the listeners to figure that one out.
Well, I do have a little bit of an explanation, because Bennett can't go on trips in the beginning of the week because that's when the Knesset votes, Monday through Wednesday. And so he has to make his trips Thursday, Friday, when possible, because it's such a narrow coalition and he's a Knesset member, so he has to vote. So that explains it somewhat, but it is pretty ridiculous how many times this has happened.
Lahav, tell us what happened when Zev Elkin, who's the housing minister, goes with Bennett. He's the translator, right? He's been doing this for a long time. He did it back for Bibi. He's doing it now for Bennett. And then Bennett returns to Israel, goes to the cabinet meeting on Sunday, and tells a story which everyone seems to laugh at, which I did not find too funny. But why don't you tell us what that was?
Well, we'll start with the one that is actually funny, I think. Bennett called Elkin the man in the bag. The reason he called Elkin the man in the bag is because in all of the pictures and the videos that came out from this Bennett-Putin meeting, Elkin, who is there, he's housing and construction minister, Zev Elkin, and he has served as the official translator for meetings with Vladimir Putin, basically for the last decade. He did it for Netanyahu, and now he's doing it for Bennett. And in all these pictures, he's carrying like a white shopping bag, which looks very ridiculous. I mean, it just looks very like schleppy that he's doing that in these meetings with these leaders, you know? And then he explained it that like embassy representatives gave him like the confidential papers that he's supposed to be presenting to Putin, and they gave it to him in this bag. So he just took it, which is, you know, okay. Like they don't have a briefcase. They don't have something more like respectable, but
that's what happens when you're operating like you're in a shtetl, then you look like you're in a shtetl.
So that part is just a little bit silly, right? And it sparked all kinds of memes online. And Elkin's wife, who's a very funny woman, Maria, she wrote on Facebook, next time I'll bring him a bag from Rami Levy, which is a supermarket chain in Israel. Anyway, the more serious story, which yes, it's like, you don't know whether to laugh or cry at this story, is that Bennett told the cabinet that, like, you know, the meeting with Putin was supposed to be 3 hours and it went on for 5 hours. And around into the fifth hour or so, he was saying something and then Elkin didn't translate it. And Bennett turned around and looked at Elkin, and Elkin had fallen asleep, and Bennett elbows Elkin, and then Elkin, you know, wakes up and actually is immediately able to translate what Bennett said, somehow had been half asleep, half listening. But then Putin laughed at them, like to their faces, and said to Elkin, I can see that you weren't in like an elite commando unit like Bennett was.
Which That's is cute. And it's cute. It's funny. And Bennett retold it at the cabinet meeting, and all the ministers, you know, it elicited a nice laughter from ministers. But I don't know. There's something about it which to me was not amusing. The Russian president is probably one of the shrewdest, cunningest, devious leaders in the world, who's thinking numerous steps ahead on the geopolitical chessboard. When Israeli officials are meeting him on life and death issues like Syria or Iran or whatever it might be, you can't. I mean, it's obviously human to get tired, but to fall asleep while translating a key diplomatic meeting. I mean, like, and then to make a laugh, like a joke about it. I don't know.
Right. And Elkin's explanation was, well, they offered Bennett coffee, but nobody offered me anything. Like, seriously, dude, like if you're so tired that you're going to fall asleep in this meeting, just ask for a coffee, maybe. Like, I just, yeah, it boggles the mind. And Elkin is a very serious person. That's the thing, is that I have, you know, political views, whatever aside, I have huge respect for him and just like his intellect and his own ability to like play 3D chess. But this was ridiculous.
No, but this all, it smacks of amateurism. I'm sorry to say it, but the way that thing with Putin, now maybe he fell asleep. By the way, keep it quiet. Why make it public? Why make yourself publicly look like you're a shtetl with senior officials falling asleep after a long journey to appeal to the czar, right? Why make that public? Just keep it quiet. And when you combine that with what's going with the way this whole NGO terror designation was handled, it's hard not to reach a conclusion that this government is just not performing on the diplomatic level the way it's supposed to. And listen, I'm a fan of, I think the budget's important. The way they've combated the Delta virus with the booster and other steps without bringing us to a lockdown, all very important. The fact that politics is just at a lower flame and it's less intense the way it used to be, that's good for the country too. So there's a lot of there's good aspects, but some of this stuff, it just doesn't work well. And they got to get their act together.
Yeah, you know, also when it comes to Iran, sometimes I feel like the things that come out from this government are incredibly naive. Now, it could be that they're intentionally sounding naive because they don't want to be in a public fight with Washington. And they've said they don't want to be a public fight with Washington. But just, you know, it's very clear that the Biden administration's like view and interest on this front is so divergent from Israel's. You know, they're really pushing for a deal with Iran. I wouldn't say at all costs, but like they're waiting what I think is beyond a reasonable amount of time for Iran to return to the negotiating table. It's almost 5 months at this point, when the talks themselves only went on for 2 months. And in Israel, it's like, everything's fine. We're talking with them. We're totally coordinated. You know, there are a few things where I'm like, yes, it's amateur hour. They need to step it up.
Lahav, just quickly, with the 2 minutes we have left, give us the lowdown on Glasgow. So Bennett's going there. Climate change, something I can't say that we write that much about it. Israeli officials don't talk so much about it. Suddenly the prime minister is going to a summit about it. What's going on?
Well, first of all, I think that this government has taken a serious interest in the issue. And like the amount of, you know, the statements that they've made in the past 4 months are more than the statements they made in the 2 years preceding it that I was, you know, covering the cabinet. You know, there's a serious environmental protection minister, Tamar Zandberg, who's, you know, long been an activist in the field and understands it. And Bennett seems to take it very seriously, the climate crisis. Now, the other thing is that, you know, and this is something I had actually criticized Bennett for when he went to New York, is in his UN speech, he didn't mention climate at all. But he should have, even though it might have been a little disjointed from the rest of the speech, because climate is a huge issue on the global agenda. I mean, it's what at least the countries that Israel considers to be like-minded, you know, the global north, so to speak, you know, it's what everybody is talking about. It is very, very focused on, from the Biden administration to Boris Johnson in the UK. So those are two different political sides, right? Liberal and conservative, you know, to really the EU. It's a hugely important issue. And it's just become the number one thing, I think, one of the number one things on the international agenda. And it's important for Bennett to be there. And it's also, I think, like easy points on the diplomatic level for Israel and for Bennett, because you know, Israel's not the best in the world, but Israel has set, I think, pretty ambitious goals. We've moved from coal to natural gas, which is clean energy, although not renewable. You know, we are like a huge hub of innovation on all kinds of things relating to climate change, whether it's, you know, food solutions, cultured meat, agriculture, desert agriculture is a big thing. And so Israel wants to show up to this conference, to COP26 in Glasgow, and to sort of put its best foot forward and show, you know, what Israel can contribute.
When you're there, when they're talking about climate change, maybe you could talk to them about how to also do some climate change within the government, right? That might help to an extent.
Yes, because lately it's been very stormy.
Yeah. Well, Lahav, next week, we're gonna record right when you get back from your trip to Glasgow. So we'll have more for you listeners from the climate change summit that Prime Minister Naftali Bennett will be at. Lahav Harkov will be there as well. And now our interview with Gerald Steinberg, the founder and Professor Gerald Steinberg, the founder and president of NGO Monitor, who did a lot of the work upon which the Defense Ministry and Justice Ministry based their decision to designate these six Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations. Here we go.
So this week on the Jerusalem Post podcast, we want to welcome Professor Gerald Steinberg, the founder and president of NGO Monitor, to talk about this move by the government to ban six Palestinian organizations for alleged ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a designated terrorist organization in Israel, the U.S., the EU, Canada, Australia, I'm sure other places as well. So why did the government move to do this? Well, what do you have any idea what changed now that made the government decide to designate these organizations as terrorist groups?
I think it's a process that's been going on intensively for a couple of years and perhaps behind the scenes a little bit here and there before then. The most important event happened in August 2019, tragically, when Rina Schnerb, a 17-year-old Israeli, was hiking with her father and her brother, and an explosive was detonated, and she was killed in the process. And a few months later, a number of Palestinians were arrested for that as part of the PFLP terror cell that detonated, that made the weapon, that planted the weapon, and that detonated it remotely. And it turned out that the head of the cell, a gentleman by the name of Samir Abid, who was arrested for this and is now on trial, is also a senior official. I think he was the treasurer in charge of the accounting and finances in one of these six NGOs. It was the Union of Agricultural Workers Committee. And there was another, I think, UAWC staffer that was also among the people that were arrested for taking part in this PFLP cell. And I'm trying to read between the lines here. Nobody said to me, oh, that's going to change everything. But I saw a greater concern among people in the security establishment and also some political leaders about the process by which organizations that are under the label of NGOs that work in fields. The Agricultural Workers Committee does aid. It's a humanitarian aid. It supposedly helps Palestinians farming. But that they began to understand that there is a network of NGOs where there are a number of PFLP activists, members, I don't like that term, people who are involved in PFLP terror activities and also have very senior positions in these NGOs. There's a pattern. There's a pattern that I and NGO Monitor recognized a number of years ago, and we saw there was more attention being paid to this by the security establishment. So I think over the 2 years that have passed since then, after the arrest, the trials, they looked at other cases where there are clear connections between the organizations and the PFLP. There were further arrests. A couple of months ago, something called the Health Workers Committee, which is a similar type of framework, was also designated as a terrorist organization. Actually, there are seven because that was the first, and they added the six. They also told Israeli diplomats to make representations in Europe to the governments that are funding these organizations. So we know, for instance, that was something that was done in the case of in Belgium and a couple of other countries, where particularly when ministers came to Israel and they were confronted with this information that their government is funding one of these seven NGOs that are part of the PFLP network, disguised as doing human rights or humanitarian aid.
Gerald, could you zoom out for 1 second and just explain to us, how does this whole system work? I mean, you at NGO Monitor, you and your researchers have done a lot of work and written a lot of reports over the years about how NGOs are used to delegitimize Israel, to demonize Israel, to sideline Israel. But now what's being said here is that these NGOs, and a lot of what I think the defense ministry in its decision to designate these NGOs as terrorist organizations was basing a lot of its work, it seemed, on some of the work that you have done as well. But explain to us how the system works. So these are charities, right? They're supposed to be doing good things on behalf of the Palestinian people, but in fact, they're not. So how is that?
I'm going to zoom way out. I look at this whole area as an NGO industry. a multi-billion dollar or pound or euro industry that is extremely well-developed. It's very powerful. It's been developed over the last 30, 40 years and gets a lot of its money from European governments, but also a significant amount of money from private philanthropists. This is an industry that basically doesn't owe anybody any explanations or doesn't provide any explanations. There are no checks and balances. There are not even ethical guidelines in many areas of endeavors. There are ethical guidelines. There are formats by which violations of those guidelines can be assessed. All those sorts of things take place. In businesses, you have competition, but you also have all sorts of legal frameworks to prevent fraud. NGOs, and this is why I started to do this back 20 years ago, I realized they're basically given a blank check. They don't have any kind of limitations. If you call yourself a human rights organization and you got enough money to do the PR behind it and you have enough supporters, you become de facto considered a human rights organization. You become de facto considered to be part of civil society. Now, it's a whole long story, which I won't get into. What do we mean by civil society in a closed society like the Palestinians? Are there real opportunities for NGOs to operate independent of a political patron? And I would argue that no. I argue that all these organizations operating in the Palestinian framework are essentially either part of close to Fatah or close to PFLP, in some cases Hamas and other organizations. So that's the big picture. And they make they have a huge amount of money. They have a lot of political influence. So I began to look at this. I was a pioneer in this. This was 20 years ago.
No, that I know. But the money that goes to these NGOs. So some of it is going towards charitable work, I'm guessing, but also some of it is being diverted or funneled to actually fund terrorist activities?
And that's the bottom line. Because there were no checks and balances, I started to say that's why I started to look at this. It's a huge and a very important sector or industry with a lot of money. We're talking on the Palestinians, roughly maybe 35 to 40 million euros a year go into a small number of Palestinian NGOs. Not only these seven, there are more than that, but maybe there are 15 that account for most of the money year after year. So they have their patrons. There's a lot of money, and their patrons are largely European governments. Particularly among Palestinian NGOs, what are the checks and balances? Most of the money disappears because it goes into Gaza, it goes into the PA, and there's no way that European officials can monitor the use of money. One of the things, by the way, and this is very important, that the Ministry of Defense has in these designations and has stated both in the previous case, now in the case of the six, is that they say that the evidence is that the money is being diverted from the NGOs straight into PFLP terror activities. There was an arrest a couple of months ago of one of the health worker committee people for having diverted tens of millions of euros over a number of years that were designated for health purposes from European governments. So the main point that's being argued now is that the And this is beyond what NGO Monitor did, because we didn't have that kind of information. We just identified the people that had both hats. But now the Ministry of Defense and the security agency, the security people, the Shabak, are saying that the money that goes in, again, we're talking about tens of millions of euros and dollars a year, gets diverted by these individuals who are wearing both hats to terrorist organizations and activities like mm-hmm. the PFL.
Basically, these organizations are money laundering operations.
Significant part of what they do has to do with money laundering, yes.
Right. I've noticed some movements in Europe on these issues. In the Netherlands, I think they're investigating. Do you think things are getting better? And then also, I guess a lot of the governments say, oh, it's not a smoking gun. Just because someone works for an organization who is also a member of a terrorist organization doesn't make the whole organization, tied to terrorism. So what do you answer those people?
Exactly. Both things that you said are correct, even though they're contradictory. There is some movement. The Netherlands was one of probably the first. Netherlands and Switzerland, a little bit in Germany, and then to the EU back in the 90s, even earlier in the late 80s. Began to have partnerships with Palestinians, the first who ran what are now called NGOs. In those days, they were informal groups or they had academic frameworks. But Al-Haq was the first one. And they began to develop partnerships, in many cases through church organizations. One of the things that distinguishes the PFLP and these NGOs is a high concentration of Christians with church-based connections to Europe. So these connections go back many, many years. And it was very difficult in the Netherlands for the minister in those days of international aid, Minister Haag, to say that she acknowledged after she was questioned in Parliament that she said it's possible that the money from the Dutch government that was given to the Agricultural Workers Committee was used to pay the salaries of Samir Arbida and other people who are other indicted terrorists, arrested and indicted terrorists, and they were going to investigate that. And that investigation is ongoing. So, yes, you do have that very reluctant willingness. At first, they denied it. They said, no, it couldn't possibly be. This is just a Israeli propaganda claims. This was in response more to NGO Monitor than the government. But later on, that became also a response to Israeli government points. The EU has got a couple of investigations going, including by the corruption unit, the anti-corruption unit, totally in secret, but it'll be interesting to see. So there are some changes in willingness to some degree, I'd say a limited degree, to engage on the possibility that maybe the money was being abused. But I think the dominant theme, and we see it a lot in the last 24, 48 hours that we hear from Europe, is it can't be. These are wonderful people. They do wonderful things for human rights organizations. This is an attempt to shut down criticism. It's part of the occupation and prevention of the Palestinians from raising their voices on in the areas of human rights and international law. And because these organizations are involved, Al-Haq in particular, in the campaign through the International Criminal Court to open investigations and bring Israelis to trial. So that's there. Many of the official voices claim that this is an attempt to shut this down by the Israelis without looking at the actual information. I think that as the information is provided by the Israeli government to government officials in Europe, that we'll start to see somewhat of a change.
No, just part of what I find to be absurd about a lot of the European sort of response to these claims, and even before the government was making it, or when it was the Strategic Affairs Ministry a few years ago, as opposed to the Defense Ministry now, it's like they sort of deny that money is fungible, right? Like, I'm looking now at a tweet from the Swedish consulate in Jerusalem that deals with the Palestinians, and they said, previous allegation of misuse of Swedish funds not substantiated. Like, I think that they kind of were substantiated, but they can pretend that their money going to some agriculture project is only going to agriculture when that organization also funds terror. It's like a very, it's like they're playing dumb.
Well, there are a couple of layers to this. First of all, I go back to the point that these are really I look at these NGOs in many cases as European government subcontractors. That's one of their main connections. They look at the Palestinian Authority as corrupt. They don't want to give them money and deal with them. But NGOs, civil society, they're wonderful people doing wonderful things. And therefore, we can give them money and they can provide us with access, information, influence. It's the same agendas. And if you look at the project titles, it's always the same organizations. The project titles kind of change. And now they're doing Jerusalem the last 3 years because the Americans moved their embassy to Jerusalem. And therefore, it's the way of European money and diplomacy countering the Americans. That's also an element here. But it's a cult-like process. They really look at NGOs as something holy. Religious, maybe, is a better term. And you can't. It's impossible that they would do things that would not be altruistic and supporting human rights and all those other things. And I think that's reflected exactly in the Swedish consulate's tweet, but in many other responses across the board. It'll be interesting to see when the Israeli officials do the briefings, and we don't know what those are going to be, but I suspect they'll be black and white. I would hope the black and white or color even evidence, hard evidence of transfer of significant European funds to terror activities or disappearing into the PFLP coffers. And they're going to have to deal with that. It's going to be much harder for them to cling to this image of NGOs being pure and wonderful and incorruptible.
Gerald, you mentioned the briefings, right? And we all know that based on the news reports, so Defense Minister Benny Gantz on Friday made an announcement of the designation of these NGOs as terrorist organizations. It was met by a response by Ned Price, of the spokesperson of the U.S. State Department, saying, "We're going to ask for clarifications. We didn't know about this." Israel then on Saturday night, defense officials briefed journalists and said, "We actually did update our U.S. counterparts through defense channels. Maybe it didn't make its way to the State Department, but anyhow, we're sending foreign ministry people and Shabak people to the United States to brief them, maybe also to Europe." All great. How come, in your opinion, you guys have been working on this for years, right? The Strategic Affairs Ministry has put together reports on this already a couple of years ago. There was readily available, I could call it like Hasbara pamphlets and material, or that could have been put together in videos and in reports and briefings to journalists. None of that happened. I mean, to me, that's a huge slip up by Israel. Right. You know, this thought that you can just designate NGOs as terrorist groups without proving anything, without having to show anything for it. What's your take on that?
Let's back up a little bit. Jakob, let's back up a little bit. And I'll do it briefly because there are three different levels. In terms of the work that NGO Monitor did, we really are an NGO. We're a non-governmental organization that doesn't take government money from anybody and has no formal ties with any government. When we go and we brief, and I've sat with many ambassadors and sometimes foreign ministers and other people and brief them on the information. And we say, here are six members of the PFLP. Here are the pictures on Facebook that our researchers find that where they are participating in a PFLP ceremony, some sort of event honoring a terrorist that was killed in some clash. And they're called commanders, these people. And they're all here, the same people, with their pictures, and here they are in working for Defense for Children International Palestine, exactly the same people. And the Europeans look at this, the officials, and they say, well, yeah, okay, but it's a political party. The PFLP is a political party. It doesn't mean that they're terrorists. And so they have excuses. They have built in, it's cognitive dissonance. Now, when there were specific, the case of Rena Schnerb kind of shook that. But they've only gone to the stage of saying, we have to investigate. They haven't admitted that there's something wrong with the way the process works. The funding process throughout Europe is very secret. It's like nuclear weapons. Yeah, I've tried to get through Freedom of Information documents through the European Union on how they decide who they're going to fund. And it's impossible. It's absolutely impossible to get any significant information of how the decisions are made, who makes those decisions. When the Strategic Affairs Ministry, Gilad Erdan, took this information in a very high quality in terms of graphics and details publication to Brussels and presented it in the European Parliament and sent it to the officials, including Mogherini, who was the high representative for the European Commission in for foreign policy. And they wrote back, Mogherini wrote back and said, there are a number of mistakes and you have not proven your case. That's a paraphrase. Because it was there were wars between the different ministries in those days, tensions, let's say, there was not much of a follow-up that we could see. Erdogan didn't follow up and say, okay, I'm going to come to Brussels. Let's sit down and talk next time, and we'll sit down and we'll go through the detail. It was kind of dropped. So I think that was another, I agree, that was something that I missed opportunity. This is different. This is a very detailed, formal, complex legal process.
So it should have had, if it's complex, it should have come with and been accompanied by a briefing, an announcement, presenting evidence, a video, something. But there was nothing.
Okay. I agree with you. I think that there should have been better preparation for this. And perhaps, again, they did not realize the kind of implications that this would take, that this would cause. Also, by the way, within the government, it's not clear to what degree Yair Lapid, the foreign minister, was briefed on this. I think he said that they weren't briefed, but I'm not sure. And the other ministers were said that they were not aware of this before. Lahav knows more about this than I do. The way it was released, it was planned for, as I understood it, to be released this week, but for reasons which are not clear, it got out earlier, got out on Thursday afternoon or Friday morning, and they weren't prepared. They do have videos because they're putting them out now. Those weren't prepared in the last 24 hours. But
right.
It was done in a way that did not smooth the process of understanding.
Right. Well, Gerald, we appreciate the time, and really, I think it's for anyone who's been following NGO Monitor as we have, and as if you read the Jerusalem Post, you know that we do write a lot about your reports, about NGO Monitor reports. This is a clear, I think, support of the work that you've been doing. So kol hakavod to you and to your staff over at NGO Monitor, and thanks for coming on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
I appreciate the invitation and look forward to further issues to be discussed.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We're available on all major podcast platforms, so be sure to recommend us to all your friends and family. And we will be back next week, where I will be talking about more about COP26, the climate conference in Glasgow. See you then.